The Cash for Clunkers program ended last night. This car trade-in program was designed to boost auto sales, get more energy-efficient vehicles on the roads, and also incidentally help struggling Detroit car companies. But the biggest beneficiaries, according to the government, were foreign makes. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports.
As of last Friday, 59% of the vehicles bought with Clunkers Cash were foreign. The top two sellers, the Toyota Corolla and Honda Civic. The only Detroit vehicles in the top 10 were the Ford Focus and Escape. That's all from the Department of Transportation. Foreign firms control the majority of the U.S. market, but they did even better than usual in the Clunkers program. Carl Brower is the editor of Edmunds.com, the car consumer website. He says the reason is simple. The Clunker program favored gas economy, something Detroit is still working on.
They tend to make better trucks than they do fuel-efficient cars, and that's shifting, but right now the imports still definitely have the advantage there.
Brower says if Congress had tried to tilt the program more towards Detroit,
then we'd have gotten into all sorts of trade issues with the program, and you'd have people yelling that it was slanted unfairly to benefit the domestic automakers.
That said, the program did help U.S. manufacturers. It cleared old inventory off dealer lots and recently encouraged General Motors to bring back more than 1,300 workers to build more cars. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. This week, we visit the world of low-tech photography and bring it up to date. A lot of us still have a treasure trove of old photos, negatives, slides, stuffed in shoeboxes or in albums in a basement or a closet. Now there are companies that will scan them into digital form, though often at a hefty price. NPR's Laura Seidel has a profile of one company that's managed to make preserving those old memories a more affordable proposition.
How many pictures are in shoeboxes? Sam Allen, CEO of Scan Cafe, actually commissioned a study to find out.
In the U.S. right now, there are about 550 billion analog photographs.
That's 550 billion. That's a lot of photos. Allen says most people don't realize that they're taking a risk by letting them sit around.
These images are dying every day, and they die a little bit more, and they fade away, and people don't understand that.
For less than $300, anyone can buy a scanner. But to scan all those photos, Allen tries to do the math.
And so if you want to scan, 1,000 photographs at 4 minutes per scan time, plus another five in post-scan processing, then you're talking thousands of minutes of your time.
And there's where he saw a business opportunity. People send their photos to Scan Cafe and pay the company to put them in digital form, and it will also Photoshop out the flaws. The company's Wade Legrone holds up a photo of a customer's grandfather back in Eastern Europe. Judging by his black hat and long side locks, he's a Jew. But it's hard to see the details of his features because of cracks and fading in the picture.
Just a massive amount of dust and noise and tiny little scratches that make it look as if this photo were taken in a snowstorm.
Legrone then shows me what the same photo looks like after their technicians process it. It looks great.
And that photograph, if you've gotten it, you would never know it ever been damaged.
Damaged old pictures were on Chrissy Knudsen's mind last year when she realized that her family photos were at risk. Her mother was asked to evacuate her house during last year's fires in Southern California.
I said, "Mom, just please don't lose these pictures."
Knudsen's mother put them in storage.
So they're just in these boxes and albums and loose and all this stuff. So I'm taking like kind of a box at a time every time I see her.
Knudsen has been taking them, sorting them, and sending them to Scan Cafe. Each photo and color negative cost 29 cents a piece. That's nearly half the price of the largest competitor, Scan Digital. The catch is Knudsen has to send all her photos to the Scan Cafe plant in Bangalore, India. And it can take as long as 6 weeks before she sees them again. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
And to talk about how you can better preserve your personal photo archive, we're joined now, as we are most Mondays, by Omar Gallego, who covers technology culture for the Austin American-Statesman and for All Tech Considered. Welcome, Omar.
Hi, Robert. Good to be here.
And we heard in Laura's piece about the pricing for Scan Cafe services, 29 cents a piece. I imagine that's why they're scanning in Bangalore?
Yeah, I actually spoke to Sam Allen, the CEO of the company, previously, and he told me that he believes ScanCafe has the largest scanning facility in the world, with hundreds of workers trained in photo restoration and scanning.
But is this really such a labor-intensive proposition that you have to seek out a cheaper labor market to do it?
For basic scanning, it's something most people can handle on their own, but the very deep photo restoration that they talk about in the piece, most people wouldn't know how to do that, even if they had a copy of Photoshop. And it's so complex that a lot of it requires really a human touch. There is software that can do some auto-correction to photos, but for the real fine-tuning, for fixing a tear in a photo or the kind of snow that we talked about in the picture, mm-hmm. you really need to have some skills to be able to do that. It's very complicated.
Well, for people who own such photos balk at the notion of sending them off to Bangalore for a month and a half, are there any scanners available that are faster than the traditional flatbed ones that some people already have?
Yeah, there is a category of scanner called a sheet-fed scanner that can handle multiple documents at once. They're usually a little bit more expensive than flatbed scanners, and you still have to process the photos. You still have to bring them into the software and save the file and set the size and all that. But for very fragile photos, like I said, you'd really want to be careful about running them through any kind of sheet feeder. I mean, it's a really good way to destroy a photo and tear it even further if it's something that's very old and fragile.
I mean, one of the reasons that we would want to do this to our old photos is the fear that they'll continue to fade and eventually we might not be able to see anything on the pictures. So let's say they're turned into digital files. Are they permanently restored? Where do they reside once they're digital files?
Well, anyone that's ever had a hard drive crash knows that digital data is definitely not permanent or safe unless you take precautions. I mean, backing up all those important documents to an external hard drive, that's become pretty commonplace. We see a lot of that now. But there are a lot of devices from flash drives to off-site storage services that are other alternatives. The real big issue that I found that people are worried about now is what happens if there's a fire or flood or theft. You lose your data even if you have it protected somewhere in your home. In my home, I actually use what's called a Drobo, which is short for data robotics. It's a small black box that contains multiple hard drives. So if one hard drive goes bad, you still have the data intact. Everything is still there. You just swap out the drive and you're good to go. But like I said, that doesn't help you if you have a fire, flood, or theft. So offsite services are becoming more and more popular. That stuff lives on the cloud. You can access it from anywhere. And you have the security of letting someone else manage your data instead of having it be in danger in your home.
Omar, so far we've been talking about old photos. What about old videos or old 16mm films or old Super 8 films for that matter?
Well, there are a lot of gadgets and software to transfer your old movies to your computer, a lot of them for under $50. The problem is with a lot of the older devices, a lot of the 16mm and high 8, it may not have the right kind of connection to interface with those devices and plug into your computer. But if you do have, say, VHS or Beta or something that does connect, once you've got those digital files, there are online services that allow you to share those files or even edit your videos online. One just debuted this month. It's called Pixorial.com, and it features online editing of your digital videos and the ability to get those videos burned to a DVD or to share them online with family and friends. Now, if you don't have the tools to interface with your computer, they will actually do it for you. You can just mail in your tapes or film strips, and they will digitize them. They'll be available online for you to edit and watch or share with friends. We will actually be linking to Pixorial.com and a lot of the other resources we've been talking about on the All Tech Considered blog at npr.org/alltech.
And while we're on the subject of npr.org, we'd like to announce the opening of our first ever All Tech Considered Photography Exhibition, featuring the work of none other than you, our listeners. We asked you to send us your favorite summer images, and over the past 2 months we've received hundreds of submissions. Our multimedia team has compiled some of these images into a very impressive gallery, and we invite you to visit and peruse. Thanks to all of you who sent us your photographs. It's all at the new NPR.org. Thank you, Omar.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
Omar Gayaga, who covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman and for All Tech Considered. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
So here's the situation at Citi Field in Queens yesterday afternoon. The New York Mets trail 9-7, bottom of the ninth. Philadelphia Phillies second baseman Eric Bruntlett muffs two ground balls to put the tying runs on first and second. With nobody out, the Mets try the hit-and-run play. Both runners take off as the pitcher delivers. Mets batter Jeff Francoeur smacks a line drive right into Bruntlett's glove. That's one out. Bruntlett then steps on second base to double up the lead runner, two outs, and then turns and tags the man running toward him from first. ball game over on an unassisted triple play. That is baseball's ultimate rarity, so unusual that baseball nerds treasure the name of Bill Wamsgans, the author of the only unassisted triple play in the World Series in 1920. According to the Elias Sports Bureau, Bruntlett is just the 15th fielder to pull off the trick in the major leagues and just the second ever to end a game. The only other example dates to 1927. Two other feats in baseball are almost as unusual. One batter belts two grand slams in a single game, and a perfect game where a pitcher retires every man he faces, 27 up, 27 down. Both have happened fewer than 20 times in history. Both have happened this year. In today's New York Times, George Bretherton reminded us of the philosopher Joaquin Andujar, a major league pitcher who once said that life and baseball can be summed up in a single word: you never know. If for some reason you were not glued to the Mets-Phillies game yesterday, we've posted a link to the video of the triple play. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Tomorrow, the cast of TV's 30-something joins us 20 years later. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Every so often on Morning Edition, we talk food with the food writer, Nigella Lawson, and food TV star, we should add. She writes that summer food contains within it the idea of simple cooking. Nigella joined us from London to talk about how to use one special ingredient.
I'm surrounded by fritters and various other things, which we're going to talk about here. Mm. But maybe we begin with an ingredient that you have suggested as we're dealing with wonderful kinds of summer foods, late summer foods. You like to work with feta cheese. Why is that?
I'm a great fan of feta cheese. I suppose, you know, there are various reasons. One, which is that when it's summer, I think shopping is really so much worse sometimes than cooking. So I feel that you can have some feta cheese in the fridge, and once when it's in its vacuum pack, it stays for a long time. And I don't know whether this is romantic or real, but I have the notion in summer that an impromptu eating occasion pops up more often, and so I like to have things to hand. I also think, and I say this as a very committed carnivore, that in the summer months, I don't know that I miss eating meat as much. Having a vegetarian meal seems somehow more natural. Maybe it's because it's less heating.
Well, it's seasonal. I mean, the vegetables are there.
I suppose so, but I suppose, on the other hand, you know, something I would add, this somehow may be coarse to say this, but we all know that really our bodies are self-regulating mechanisms, and we see that in infants. And I dare say that when it's hot, you lose liquid and salt through sweating, therefore it's quite natural to want a very salty cheese. Was that too indelicate?
No, that makes perfect sense. That makes perfect sense. What we've got here, this is eggplant, and it's been wrapped around some feta cheese. Maybe you can explain a little more what's going on here. There's some mint supposedly involved. I'm just going to take a bite while you describe it.
Supposedly. Well, really, these are like little wraps, but instead of using, say, a tortilla or something, mm-hmm. I use a ridge griddle, but you can do them on
looks
a grill.
Looks like a little
really.
Egg roll, actually.
Yes, it is. It's a bit of eggplant, and what I do is I brush the eggplant with oil rather than leaving it to soak, because when you do that, those eggplants, I mean, they can drink up cups and cups of oil. I just crumble a bit of feta with, I like a seeded red chilli, but it depends whether you want real fire or just heat. Some fresh mint. I go mad for mint in summer. I think it's very undervalued. Mm. And a bit of lemon and just some pepper.
Do you want
and
to just keep talking them. For a minute? Because I'm going to take another bite here.
I think these are great because I think they're very flexible. So if you're having people over for drinks, you're not actually feeding them. They will do then. Best of all, you can just do them the day before, 2 days before, and then get rolling. I also am a great believer in child labour, and although maybe giving them a chili is mean, you could get children to roll these. And I think, in a funny way, you could have them with a glass of white wine, or you could beef them up with a jacket potato as the evening was cooling.
Now, the reason that the studio smells wonderful this morning is mostly because of these zucchini fritters, which I'm eating with my hands. I guess they're about the size of a cookie. Can you describe what's going on here?
Well, this is something I think I must have eaten a version of when I was in Turkey once. Mm-hmm. And I did think it was absolutely extraordinary that you could have a fritter and instead of it feeling like it was some sort of pancake or something heavy that one associates with comfort food, it tasted almost as if there'd been the juice of the vegetable. So you had the vegetable juice in a way because the strands of zucchini are so thin. Mm-hmm. And the feta for salt. And then again, I've gone, into mint overdrive. But
oh, we've got feta. Also, did you say feta in here again?
Yes.
We've got,
okay. I'm sorry. I've gone absolutely, fantastic. And it's not an enormous amount of flour. I suppose it's that they're eggy rather than floury. So I suppose it's a bit like little cakes of herby zucchini scrambled eggs. It's an odd taste in a way because you really are going there on sweetness. Maybe the eggs are.
I'm trying to describe the flavor of these zucchini fritters. This isn't an exact parallel at all, but I am thinking a little bit of quiche.
Yes, I suppose that's right, because I suppose it is like an egg custard.
And the ones that I'm eating here are a little bit, they're warm, but they're not hot. Mm. I can eat them again with my hands. And this is the way to do it, is close
sure
to room
is.
Temperature. I'm tempted to eat another one. They're so tasty.
But anyway, it makes sense at this time of year because zucchini, eggplant, so forth, they tend to be, quite plentiful. So why not make them, the star of the meal rather than having them just as a side dish?
Should we proceed to dessert or is there more to deal with before I go after this little bit of dessert that's been put in front of me?
I think dessert would be fine now.
Okay, now this is basically just some store-bought ice cream. But on top of the store-bought ice cream is the news here, which is... Well, you describe what we've got here. This is blackberries and...
It's really just a sauce of blackberries. So if you imagine making a jelly, I suppose, but instead of cooking it for a long time with tons of sugar, I've got a bit of balsamic vinegar. Now, an Italian taught me that because she always puts balsamic vinegar with strawberries. Just brings out the taste enormously. It's not very much, and there's also a bit of lemon, but really you're trying to keep a balance between the sharpness of the berries, or maybe tartness is a better word, because I think that makes them taste fresh. I hate having sugar swamping everything.
I love that you tried a little bit of vinegar, which I don't taste at all. I'm just wondering how you come about that. Do you experiment with different kinds of liquids and sauces, throw in a little lighter fluid or whatever works until you finally come around to vinegar, and that's the perfect thing?
Well, the vinegar started off, as I say, because I knew that the Italians put vinegar, balsamic vinegar, on their strawberries. So I had a kind of a clue there. But I think really that I do try quite a lot. And luckily, greed is such a motivator that I can look at the recipe now and think, do you know what? Maybe it'd be rather nice that if instead of the lemon and vinegar, why not try a bit of red wine? You might have some red wine over from supper. Let's just bung that in with the blackberries. How would that be? So I think you've always got to be prepared. And then maybe to counter the red wine, especially if it's been out for a while, maybe a teeny bit of honey. So I'd always be in my head thinking, how can I make this work? The worst that can happen is it doesn't taste fantastic.
And then you just drink a glass of red wine and everything's okay, basically.
Well, by the time I got to dessert, I think I've had more than one glass in me, I have to say.
Well, Nigella Lawson, maybe we'll try to get you back to talk a little bit more about cooking in the fall.
I'd love that.
She's the author of Nigella Express and many other cookbooks. Such a pleasure to listen to Nigella Lawson, and you can hear her describe her ideal Greek salad at the new NPR.org, where you'll also find some of the recipes we just discussed. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Say your goodbyes. Tonight marks the final sales deadline of the Cash for Clunkers program. An estimated 600,000 low-mileage cars have been traded in, and $3 billion federal dollars will have been spent. Well, commentator Julie Zicafus, a former clunker driver herself, has this appreciation for the brief and wildly successful program.
I was going to buy a used car eventually, just one not quite as used as mine. A 1995 Ford Explorer with 178,000 miles on it, dicey shocks and transmission, and an insatiable appetite for fuel. Before the Cash for Clunkers program came onto my radar screen, I had said it again and again, I'm going to drive this thing until it falls apart under me. I was sure we'd pass the 200,000-mile mark together. After all, we'd been through a lot. That Ford carried me into the hospital twice when I was in labor. We strapped our new babies into its back seat, fumbling with the buckles and straps. Both kids grew up in it, and the slow and steady rain of Cheerios gave over to Nerds and bubblegum and an orange dum-dum embedded in the back carpet, stick pointing up. There were bumper stickers from Maine to North Dakota. There was Give Turtles a Break. There were dog stickers and flower-powered daisies and Life is Good stickers, and during the 2008 election, there were some pointed ones that got me more than a few hairy eyeballs from other drivers, maybe even a ticket or two. Mice lived in it off and on, including one mama mouse who had the bad judgment to make a big fluffy nest and have her babies in the false fabric ceiling, which was a tenable plan until I drove the car and parked it in the sun. It took a month for me to find the defunct nest, you can imagine. The half gallon of milk that tipped over and leaked one summer day didn't help. Neither did the chicken that rolled out of a grocery bag and festered quietly in the cargo area for a week until a small flock of vultures circling low told me there was something of interest in my garage. It broke down on me only once, in a parking lot only 3 blocks from my husband's office. That car took care of me. And so, between the memories and the stickers and the mingled smells and the familiar, dependable roar of its engine, it became part of our family. I would drive it until it fell apart. Until Cash for Clunkers. Until it hit me that nobody was going to walk up and offer me $4,500 for the Mousemobile, ever. And I began to see the wisdom of starting over with a new car. No, the heady, intoxicating appeal of it. I struck the Cash for Clunkers lure like a hungry bass. But the thought of having a dealer fill its good, true heart with goo and rev the engine to death, of crushing its still strong, if rusty, body, broke my heart. It seemed so unnecessary. Couldn't they give it to someone who needed a car? When I finally closed the deal on my new car, I asked the dealer to leave the Ford on the lot for a while, not to lead it into the back pasture until after I was out of sight. He chuckled. People get attached. They do. I sat quietly in it for one last time, breathing its many aromas. I looked at its stickered rump in my fancy new auto-dimming rearview mirror with compass, stepped on the gas, and headed home.
Julie Zickafoos is an artist, writer, naturalist, and new car owner living in Whipple, Ohio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Even as the healthcare debate grows louder and more partisan, one Senate group of 3 Democrats and 3 Republicans has continued to meet, searching for a compromise. Perhaps the most surprising member of this group, known as the Gang of Six, is a conservative Republican from Wyoming. He may represent the nation's least populous state, but this is one senator who's enjoying outsized influence on health care negotiations. NPR's Audie Cornish has this profile.
When the Gang of Six announced its existence earlier this year, one gang member's name raised eyebrows, Mike Enzi. Unlike the moderates and the mavericks in the group, Enzi's a free market conservative who represents one of the most reliably Republican states in the union. So even having him at the table with Democrats raised questions in some quarters. The conservative-minded Club for Growth even put out a TV ad attacking the health care changes in general and calling out Enzi by name.
Politicians and bureaucrats making health care decisions, job-killing new regulations on small business, and massive tax hikes to pay for it all. Tell Senator Enzi not to cave in to the liberals on health care.
Earlier this summer, Enzi did stand his ground when he voted against the Senate Health Committee bill. But the Wyoming Republican is also a member of the Senate Finance Committee, where he was tapped to be part of the so-called Gang of Six. Enzi, the Senate's only certified accountant, has been willing to work on bipartisan deals in the past and takes this approach.
I work on an 80% rule. I anticipate and from experience have found that usually everybody can agree on 80% of the issues. And among the 80% of the issues they agree on, they can agree on 80% of any one of those issues. And you never get a perfect bill around here. If you can get 80%, you can get a lot done.
Perhaps, but it's not clear that approach is working on health care. So far, Enzi has only hardened his stance on issues like finding Medicare savings to pay for universal coverage, even though every proposal put forward so far relies on that funding mechanism. Jack Pitney, a political science professor at Claremont McKenna College, says Enzi is important as a counterweight to the other Republicans on the negotiating team, Maine's Olympia Snow and Iowa's Chuck Grassley.
Some conservative Republicans might look at Olympia Snow and say, well, she is a moderate to liberal Republican, always has been. Chuck Grassley is a bit more conservative, but has a reputation for being quirky and being a maverick. Enzi is more of a mainstream Republican. So if he comes along on something like this, there is a much stronger chance that this is going to attract some Republican support.
But that's a big if. Lately, Enzi has cast doubt on whether he or any Republican will vote for any health care bill if it contains elements such as a government-run health care insurance option. That has some in the White House and Congress considering splitting the health care overhaul into two bills. One would include bipartisan changes even Enzi could support. The other would include contentious items like the public insurance option, and it would be pushed through using a parliamentary procedure that would allow Democrats to pass a bill with a simple majority. That's a tactic Enzi has warned against for months.
It's a declaration that Republican ideas and centrist Democrat ideas are going to be left out of the mix. If we can't come up with a plan that will garner the support of at least 75 or 80 senators, this institution will not gain the confidence of the American people.
Needless to say, the gap between a bill requiring 75 or 80 senators and one requiring just 50 is vast indeed. Nonetheless, Senator Enzi says he'll still dial in for the next Gang of Six session, a teleconference set for September 4th. Audie Cornish, NPR News.